Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 6, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, a signal for quantum entanglement, how we diagnose the dead, and...
Coral reefs are potentially resilient. Clearly, what we see in the fossil record is that they were able to bounce back once these overarching climatic oscillations abated.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Quantum entanglement is a fundamental property of quantum mechanics, by which particles, like photons, electrons, or atoms, interact with one another and share the same quantum state, even when separated. Though today we can achieve entanglement, we can typically only verify it by measurement of the particle's quantum state, which in turn breaks the entanglement. But this week, a team of physicists reports on a system that provides an entanglement signal, heralding the moment at which entanglement is achieved and allowing for further analysis of the particles while still in their entangled state, even at large distances. The finding could have significant implications for quantum cryptography and communication, as well as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, an influential early critique of the theory of quantum mechanics. Science's Kerry Klein spoke with senior author Harald Weinfurter about heralded entanglement from his office in Munich.
So we are trying to create entanglement, a very special property of quantum mechanics, between two atoms which are significantly apart from each other. And the goal of all this is that this entanglement between the atoms, for example, then can be used to communicate entanglement over large distances, and then it can be used again for something like quantum cryptography, so secure communication over large distance, and in the longer future for quantum teleportation or some kind of quantum networks between quantum computers.
Okay, so before we delve any further, can you just explain what exactly is quantum entanglement?
Okay, so entanglement is one of the most specific properties of quantum objects. It's such that if we make observations of the properties of two entangled particles, then we will find correlations what we cannot describe by simple classical statistics. And so these strong correlations, what we call them, that also makes them quite useful for these quantum information applications. But also Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen in their well-known paper mentioned that this might not be in agreement with a theory which should be similar to what we know from classical physics.
And in your experiments, what particular types of particles are you entangling?
We are working with single atoms of rubidium. Rubidium is a standard species for many, many atom optics experiments because you can more or less manipulate it largely with laser diodes only, and then the light which is emitted is very easy to detect. And so therefore, it simplifies many tasks in this experiment.
And you mentioned earlier that these atoms were relatively far apart. How far apart are we talking?
Okay, the distance between the two atoms is 20 meters. And this means that you need two completely independent setups. So you need one experiment more or less for one atom and another completely independent experiment for the other atom. But now having two independent experiments, you still have to synchronize them to really make them working together such that you can achieve this feat.
And how can you achieve entanglement with two particles that are so far apart?
We first entangle each of the two atoms with one photon from each of the two atoms. And these two photons now are brought together, in particular measurements on the two photons, which are similar to those what you are using for quantum teleportation, then give you a signal telling you that now the two atoms are entangled. And that is what we're using. So the story starts with first creating entanglement between an atom and a photon, and a second atom and a second photon, and then combining the two photons.
Now, one of the significant parts of this study in particular is that you've created a signal so that we know when these two atoms are entangled. Why is it important to have this signal, this herald? And could we not just tell by watching them, observing?
Yes, actually, there are experiments which are doing something like this already, also over 20 meters here in Munich. But in those cases, you more or less just know afterwards that you had this particular state, but we, with the signal, can tell, okay, now and do your measurements, you have it there. Mm. And so this actually makes many of the quantum communication protocols much easier, and it also simplifies these experiments on the Einstein-Podolsky-Boson paradox.
So once these atoms have become entangled, what kind of signal is it that you get?
Okay, that's the particular signal from the detection of the two photons, such that in order to make this measurement on the two photons, we overlap the two beams on a beam splitter, so it's a semi-transparent mirror, and then we detect them behind this mirror and analyze also their polarization. And then it depends on where in which of these four outputs then we can detect the two photons, and this tells us whether the two atoms are now entangled or not.
So it's picked up by a computer, some sort of algorithm?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everything is, of course, automatized. So it's such that the two photons are detected by single photon detectors. These signals are first analyzed by some electronics, because actually it's a pretty rare event. But then once this is done, then the two setups are more or less informed, such that they switch to another measurement mode, and they perform now the analysis of the properties of the two atoms.
Now, one thing that I found really fascinating was the time frames involved here. It's really much quicker than I had expected. So once you flip the switch, you start the experiment, how long until the atoms are entangled and you've gotten the signal?
I mean, there are two time scales. One is that it's pretty rare that we detect the photon which is emitted by one of these atoms and that it's entangled. So it's only about in every 1,000 trial we really capture the photon, because, I mean, it's emitted into all directions and our optics is capable of collecting about 1,000 altogether. And so if you have to capture two photons, then that means that you have to make about a million of trials, and then you get the two photons really to your analyzer. And so it takes about 40 seconds on average that we get one of these signals that the two atoms are entangled in.
And that's 40 seconds for about a million trials?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
But, I mean, the computer takes over, so, I mean, we don't have to do too much there.
Right.
I mean, once the experiment runs, all the work is done already.
So this must really have a lot of applications in quantum physics. And as you said, it could be applied towards communications and quantum networks and cryptography and things like that. Can you go into some more details about what this could eventually be used for?
One of the big goals for quantum communication is actually really to provide a link over long distance. So in the moment, quantum cryptography applications are more or less limited to something like 50 kilometers, 100 kilometers, perhaps, if you still want to have a reasonable rate. There are now new superconducting single photon detectors coming on the market, which will give another perhaps factor of 3 or something like this. But if you really want to go over longer distances, you need something which is called quantum repeater. Mm-hmm. And to achieve this entanglement between these atoms over a long distance, or also perhaps between ions, this is one of the possible approaches to really communicate efficiently quantum information over long distances. One of our goals for these experiments is that there is this long-standing question of Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, whether nature can be described by a physical theory which is local and what's called realistic, which does not have this inherent randomness built into it. And quantum physics is not like this, obviously. And the question is whether one should change quantum physics. We hope that we can answer this based on the experiments, what we did now with entanglement between atoms then over 400 meters, say.
Very interesting. Well, Harold Weinfurter, thank you so much.
Welcome.
Harold Weinfurter and colleagues report on a signal for quantum entanglement in a report this week.
The Wnt signaling pathway is important in organismal development, the day-to-day life of the cell, and in the progression of cancer. In the July 3rd Science Signaling podcast, Christopher Garcia talked about his group's recent science paper on resolving the structure of Wnt.
It's kind of the perfect storm. It's a molecule with a lipid group attached at an undefined place and an undefined number of lipid groups attached. It's a molecule with many disulfide bonds, which really presents a big folding problem. And then it's a molecule that eluded structural prediction. You know, that's kind of the most difficult type of structural problem to get involved in, and that's why it took so long.
That was Christopher Garcia on the Science Signaling Podcast, talking about the structure of wnt. You can find the paper and the full podcast online at stke.sciencemag.org.
Will coral reefs survive the threats of climate change? A glimpse at the past may help answer this question. A 6,000-year-old record of coral reefs from coastal Panama suggests that reef ecosystems in the eastern Pacific collapsed for about 2,600 years. The hiatus in growth began about 4,000 years ago and was probably driven by increases in the strength and frequency of the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which in turn could have warmed the sea and inhibited coral growth. Richard Aronson and colleagues tracked the pause and rebound of these reefs over thousands of years, revealing a pattern that suggests that modern coral ecosystems might have some resilience in the face of ongoing climate change. I spoke with Aronson from his office at the Florida Institute of Technology.
Recently, strong El Niño events have killed coral populations around the world in the tropics and the subtropics, and we wanted to know if anything like that had happened in the past. So we cored reef frameworks along the Pacific coast of Panama, and the cores told us that the coral reefs stopped growing around 4,000 years ago and that they were shut down for about 2,500 years, which amounts to 40% of their 6,000-year history. Trying to get at the causes, 4,000 years ago, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, also called ENSO, intensified, and then components of that oscillation moderated around 1,500 years ago when these reefs started up again, meaning that the reefs were strongly controlled by these climatic oscillations in the long term. So the worrying thing about all this is that even the most conservative scenarios of future climate change predict these same kinds of climatic extremes, which is to say that coral reefs are in danger of another major collapse.
So what was happening in the climate and in the Pacific Ocean 4,000 years ago?
It was a complicated barrage of climatic events, all revolving around the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which we abbreviate as ENSO. First of all, around 4,100 years ago, ENSO variability increased. So that means the amplitude, the intensity of events, and their frequency started changing and started increasing. There were stronger El Niño events from about 4,000 years ago to about 2,000 years ago. At the same time, the other phase of the ENSO oscillation, the La Niña phase, peaked from about 3,800 to 3,200 years ago. Then around 2,000 years ago, La Niña, the one that had just ramped up from 38 to 3,200 years ago, that started slacking off, but El Niño events started increasing, which apparently are the conditions under which the reefs began to recover. But to summarize it, it was all about the variability of conditions that were inimical to reef growth.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar with what happens during El Niño, could you describe exactly what's going on in the weather then?
The El Niño Southern Oscillation is a complicated interaction of the ocean and the atmosphere. And the oscillation is made up of two phases, El Niño and La Niña.
Mm-hmm.
So in an El Niño event, the trade winds, which blow from the northeast in the northern hemisphere and the southeast in the southern hemisphere, slack off. And that drops the upwelling currents in the eastern Pacific off South America. And upwelling currents are the currents that bring cold, nutrient-rich water up from the depths and spread them around in shallow waters.
Mm-hmm.
So because the upwelling currents in South America have slacked off, then a lot of hot water that's been pushed to the central and western Pacific by those currents then starts to roll back down to the east, and so it gets really hot in the water in the eastern Pacific when it's normally rather cool. All of this, in interacting with the atmosphere, disrupts climate all around the world, and so some areas get heavy rains and storms, and other areas get drought. You can have heating of the tropics all the way around the planet. What happens in an El Niño event that's bad for corals is that they experience long enough periods of hot sea temperatures, then the relationship that they have with their symbiotic algae, the little single-celled algae that live inside them and feed them, essentially give them their energetic requirements, that relationship breaks down. And they spit the algae out and they turn pale, and that's why it's called coral bleaching.
how long does it take for a coral reef to recover from one of these bleaching events?
They will recover if they haven't bleached for too long. And by recovery, I mean the remaining single-celled algae, the remaining zooxanthellae, start to reproduce and repopulate them. And also they can get zooxanthellae of the same type or sometimes other types, sometimes more heat-resistant types from the environment, the free-living ones. It takes at least a year and a half for full recovery because they've literally been starving.
So getting to your study methodology, why did you look at these particular locations in Panama?
We were interested in these reefs because we knew that they had taken a pummeling from a very strong El Nino in 1982 and 1983, and then they had experienced further damage in 1997 and 1998, both of which were strong El Nino events. And we wanted to see if anything like that had happened in the past. As we started to look into their history by taking cores through the reef frameworks, we noticed this enormously long hiatus. And so we chose our sites because we wanted to see whether that hiatus was transcended an upwelling gradient. In other words, some parts of the coast of Panama have strong upwelling, and those are the areas where the mountains are low and the trade winds can blow right across the isthmus of Panama from the Caribbean. Other areas have high mountains, and they block the trade winds, so there's no upwelling there because upwelling is a wind-driven phenomenon. But what was interesting was that we saw that hiatus both in upwelling and non-upwelling areas.
So in these cores, how were you able to date the samples?
We used two really accurate methods of dating. One of those is absorption mass spectrometry, or AMS dating, and that's a type of radiocarbon dating. And the other is called inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry, or ICP-MS.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's good about doing them together is that they tell us not only the ages of the corals and help us to constrain the time at which that hiatus occurred, but they also let us know in tandem, we can use them to show that the gradient in upwelling that we see today off the Pacific coast of Panama was in place for the entire lifespan of the reefs, which is about 6,000 years.
Your study was focused on a regional effect, but is there any evidence for reef collapse in other parts of the world during this time in the Holocene?
There are tantalizing hints that this 2,500-year stoppage in reef growth, this hiatus, also occurred in other parts of the world. And in particular, we've been looking at other published records that show similar gaps along the Great Barrier Reef and in an area called Moreton Bay, which is just south of the Great Barrier Reef along the east coast of Australia, and then also in Japan, as well as back in the eastern Pacific, we've got evidence for a similar hiatus in Costa Rica.
So all of these reefs were able to recover from these collapses. So this is kind of somewhat hopeful news that coral reefs are more resilient than we previously thought. So what can we predict about the future of coral ecosystems based on your work?
I think coral reefs are potentially resilient. They're very sensitive ecosystems, but clearly what we see in the fossil record is that they were able to bounce back once these overarching climatic oscillations abated. Now the problem is that we could have conditions similar to the conditions that were poor for corals in the past, but with the overlay of other problems such as acidification and all these local issues. Global climate change will likely ramp up the intensity of the El Nino Southern Oscillation. So that could lead to another collapse of coral reef ecosystems in the eastern Pacific where we were working and possibly elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think all your listeners understand that coral reefs are in very deep trouble right now and that the threats to reefs are both local and global. And some of the local threats include things like nutrient loading, that is to say sewage and agricultural runoff. Another prominent threat is overfishing. Global threats include climate change, which is to say warming sea temperatures, as well as increases in coral diseases, which are apparently abetted by warming temperatures, and also ocean acidification. So the threats occur on at least two levels. And the real message here is that if we take local action to mitigate those local threats, then the global threats will become limiting to coral reefs. And if we can solve some of these global problems, or at least address them, mitigate them, hopefully reverse them, then the local threats will be important. So it's critical that we address threats simultaneously on both local and global levels. And if we can do that, I think there is hope for coral reefs.
Richard Aronson, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Richard Aronson and colleagues report on a 2,600-year hiatus in eastern Pacific coral reef growth.
Our ability to diagnose and treat disease continues to improve. And along with the advancing understanding of ourselves comes a desire to know more about those who came before us. In retrodiagnosis, doctors use current methods like genetics combined with historical accounts to examine illness and death among the dead and famous. I spoke with science contributing correspondent Sam Keen about a yearly conference that focuses on investigating the mysterious deaths of the likes of Christopher Columbus and King Herod.
There is a conference every year in Baltimore called the Historico-Clinico-Pathological Conference, sort of a takeoff of the normal clinico-pathological conferences that doctors do. A few weeks before the conference, you get a case study, and you get to work through it and reason through it on your own and then compare your thoughts with an expert who explains the case at a conference. The twist here, and they've been doing this for right around 20 years now, mm-hmm. is that you're dealing with a historical celebrity, someone like Edgar Allan Poe or King Herod or Christopher Columbus, who in their lifetime suffered from either some sort of mysterious ailment or died under murky circumstances. And their goal is to try to figure out just how exactly they died. And they meet in Baltimore every spring and discuss a new case.
So what kind of criteria do make it worthwhile to look back and figure out how someone died maybe 100 years ago?
There are a couple of things. First of all, again, if they died under murky circumstances,
right.
that can be great because it offers all sorts of new theories then. Other things, of course, you want someone of big historical interest. Mm-hmm. It's not as much fun if you're dealing with someone, some obscure bishop or courtier of some king no one's ever heard of. So you want a big sort of juicy story behind it. And it's best if it could help you figure out, you know, something about the person or what their life was like. It doesn't always happen that way. But if you can figure out something more about them as a person, you know, that definitely adds to the interest.
Right. So what kind of evidence is fair game in this retrodiagnosis process?
Pretty much anything you can think of. In the past, when people did this, they usually looked at historical accounts. They would look at maybe letters that someone had wrote or deathbed accounts.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, they were even looking at pictures that people drew from supposed eyewitnesses to a deathbed. And these have a lot of problems with them, these sorts of historical documents, because in some cases they were compiled hundreds of years after somebody died, so that in some cases they're as much legend as fact. And even if they were eyewitnesses, they were usually lay people recording this information, not doctors, so they weren't as precise.
Mm-hmm.
In more recent times, people have started to use autopsy reports. Mm. Autopsy reports weren't always reliable before about 1900 or so, but since then they've become a much better source of information. And even more recently, people have tried to use toxicological testing for heavy metal poisoning or something. And what's really popular now is doing DNA testing. Getting the bones or a tissue sample or hair or something and searching for genetic mutations in that.
Well, it seems like regardless of our improving technology that it would be pretty hard to diagnose someone who's been long dead. Are there any good examples of, you know, a death where we can say, oh, this case has been solved?
I would say that when you're dealing with history, there's never any cases where you can definitely say that someone died of something.
Huh.
But there are cases where you can get a pretty good idea. One I mention in the piece is Edgar Allan Poe. There was speculation at the first conference in Baltimore that he died of rabies. And this was sort of a fittingly lurid thing for Edgar Allan Poe to die of. But in looking back at it, the organizer of the conference, while he was writing a book, decided that diagnosis actually didn't hold up, mm-hmm. and it's much more probable that Edgar Allan Poe died of what most people suspected, alcoholism. He basically drank himself to death. Mm-hmm. So that's a good example of something where you can really narrow the field, and even if you don't get it definitive, you can figure out with pretty good certainty what probably happened.
So how about an example of deaths where the person's famous, they've died, but there's just no way we're ever going to know? Is that something that these retro-diagnosers also decide, that it's impossible to tell?
Well, it seems like most of them, when they come out with their diagnoses, they're definitely trying to pin the death on something. I guess you just wouldn't get a paper published if
right.
you came out and said, I have no idea what he died of. But you can tell just by the fact that there's so much arguing about this. One thing I didn't mention in the piece, but that I came across, was Charles Darwin. He was an invalid for a lot of his adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at all the things that have been proposed for what he suffered from, you can find, you know, narcolepsy, agoraphobia, lupus, pigeon allergies, lactose intolerance. You can find dozens and dozens
wow.
of just totally disparate diagnoses for him. And I think that's a pretty good example that we're probably never going to be able to pin this down. And that's especially true when you're dealing with people who died sometimes even multiple millennia ago.
Right.
This conference has looked at a pharaoh in one case. They looked at King Herod. And even when you have a little bit of information about their life, it's a little hard to pin something down like that.
Mm-hmm. So are there any ethical concerns about exposing medical conditions and people who have died, even if it was a long time ago?
Yeah, there are a couple things. Some people feel that the dead do have a right to privacy, even though they've been dead for a long time. Once they're sort of buried and underground, they should be left alone. I don't know if I quite agree with that. I don't know if you should be turning people out of their grave just willy-nilly for anything, but I'm not sure I'm convinced by the idea that the dead have a right to privacy. However, there are some legitimate concerns with DNA testing, especially because people often have living descendants, and
right.
they might not appreciate being outed as having some sort of ailment or disease. And it's not even always direct descendants. If they had, say, a brother or a sister who had children,
mm-hmm.
and those children are still alive today, they, of course, share some certain percentage of genes, and those people alive today might not appreciate you sort of trawling through their DNA like that.
So is this something that historians are also finding useful? It sounds like this is mostly the practice of these doctors.
It is doctors that are doing a lot of it. I did talk with one historian, and he had a take on it where he said he didn't think it was all that useful. He said what historians are really interested in is what the person's life was like, how they suffered, their symptoms, things like that. And he felt that pinning a label on it was a lot less important. I'm sure, of course, that if historians did know that someone died of something, they would include it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, it could change our view of what the person's life was like. But he was a little skeptical that you would learn a lot more by investigating the dead in this way.
Well, Sam Keen, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Contributing correspondent Sam Keen writes about historical diagnosis in a News Focus this week. Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, so first up, we have a story. I guess it's one step towards growing personalized organs.
Right. Sarah, that's sort of the goal of future transplant medicine. One of the really big problems with transplants right now is, first of all, having to wait for an organ from somebody else, A, and then B, hoping your body actually doesn't reject that organ. Wouldn't it be great if doctors could just take some cells from your body, grow you a new liver, and it's yours, so obviously your body is not going to reject it? Well, we're still probably a while away from that. What this new study does is it solves one of the fundamental problems in making that happen. We can grow pretty simple tissues in the lab right now. things like bladders, which are basically just sort of a thin membrane, skin, which again is just sort of a thin layer of cells. That's pretty feasible right now in the lab. The problem is when you start dealing with thick tissues like organs that are innervated with all of these blood vessels, that's a much more complicated thing to do.
So what are some of the problems with adding blood vessels to layers of cells?
The problem is how do you sort of create the channels within that tissue to put your blood vessels in? Although it might seem simple, well, why don't we just sort of build like, you know, some rubber vessels or whatever and then let the tissue grow around it? The problem is you don't want that rubber in there when you transplant the organ. So how do you get the rubber out? Well, you have to dissolve it to make room for the blood vessels and to get the rubber out of there. And to do that, you've got to use some pretty toxic elements, which are going to be bad for the tissue. So what this team did in this new study was they found a new way to sort of create these channels for blood vessels. And the way they did it was they actually sort of relied on a compound that's actually used in the candy and the cake industry.
Wow. So what kind of candy?
It's apparently used as a decoration for cakes and lollipops. And it's this sort of carbohydrate glass, and it's made out of non-toxic materials. And what's really great about it is it can be molded into a variety of shapes, and you don't have to use toxic substances to dissolve it. So once you've grown your tissue around it, the tissue itself can actually dissolve this material, and then you're just sort of left with the channels where the blood vessels could be.
Okay, so how much does this sugar scaffolding, how much closer does it get us to organs in a jar?
Well, it gets us closer in the sense that now we've got a good non-toxic way to create the channels for these blood vessels. And the researchers actually showed in the lab that they were able to keep some pretty thick tissue alive. But, you know, organs are a lot more complicated than that. It's not just a bunch of random vessels surrounded by tissue. There's very complex networks of blood vessels that have to go to specific places in the tissue, and they have to reach some places better than others. And so this is just a first step. You're not going to be seeing organs being grown in the lab tomorrow, but it does really get over one of the big roadblocks of making artificial organs a reality.
Really neat. So next up we have a story on chronic back pain. It's all in our minds, but not in the way that we usually mean.
Right. One of the problems with back pain is that there tends to be two types of back pain sufferers. One that you sort of have a temporary back pain, maybe it lasts for a few weeks or maybe a month or two, and then it goes away. And then there's another group of people that have chronic back pain that can last for a year or longer. And what's interesting is that both of these groups of people can have very similar types of injuries, and yet some of them seem to have much shorter-term pain than others. And doctors obviously want to get to the bottom of this because, especially with people with chronic back pain, they want to figure out, A, is there a way to predict who's going to get chronic pain and who's not? And if they can do that, is there a better way to treat these people so that they don't have this pain that lingers on for months or even for years?
It's my understanding that it's really hard to study pain in people. How did they do it in this case?
Well, what they did was they looked at brain scans of people, and they looked at two particular areas of the brain. They looked at a region called the insula and a region called the nucleus accumbens. And both of these regions are involved in emotional responses to a person's environment and how the brain learns. So it has to really do with how the brain sort of communicates with itself. And the interesting thing they found was they looked at 39 people who had experienced moderate back pain. They would rate the pain maybe about a 5 or a 6 on a scale of 10 for 1 to 4 months. And then over the next year, the team continued to follow these people, scanning their brains. And by year's end, 20 of the patients had recovered. So they weren't having back pain anymore. And 19 continued to hurt. So this was a great population for the researchers because some of these people were obviously suffering from chronic pain and some of them were suffering from temporary pain. And these differences played out in the brain analysis that the researchers were looking at. It turned out that people that had chronic back pain were showing more communication between these two areas of the brain, the insula and the nucleus accumbens, than patients whose pain had subsided. And what was even more interesting is they saw this pattern even way back at the beginning of the study. So it suggests that there's this type of activity in our brain that can somehow be predictive of whether we're going to be a chronic back pain sufferer or just a temporary back pain sufferer.
And do they know whether or not that signaling is always going on, or does it happen after the injury happens?
That's a really good question because, you know, one of the mysteries is, do people's brains predispose them to a certain type of pain, or does the pain cause these changes in the brain? And they really haven't been able to answer that with this study. But more so than any other study, they've really been able to nail down that there does seem to be some sort of predictive neurological marker. You just hurt your back and your doctor might be able to say, well, based on your brain scan, you know, you're just going to be dealing with this pain for a few weeks, so just take some Advil or whatever and you'll be okay. Or your doctor may say, well, look, the brain activity I'm seeing shows that you could be dealing with this pain for a long, long time. Maybe we want to get you into some intensive physical therapy. And again, the researchers are saying maybe this will lead to the development of better drugs. And especially if the pain is somehow related to this crosstalk that's happening in the brain, maybe future drugs could target this crosstalk, limit the amount of communication that these brain regions are having with each other, and maybe that could potentially reduce the amount of chronic pain these people are suffering.
Wow, that sounds pretty exciting. Okay, last up we have a story about tomatoes and how sometimes when you buy them from the grocery store, they really taste more like the cardboard that they're inside of.
Sometimes they really do. Sometimes they taste like cardboard. Sometimes people complain they taste like water. They just don't really taste like much of anything.
Right.
And this new study is all about why that is. And it turns out the reason might have something to do with tomato aesthetics.
So how they appear.
How they appear. The tomato originated in South America, but now obviously it's grown all over the world. And one of the keys to the way farmers pick tomatoes is they actually pluck the fruit from the vine before they're ripe. And the reason they do this, obviously, is because it's not going to go into the supermarket right away. So they want to have time between when they pluck it and when it appears on the supermarket shelves. Well, it used to be a long time ago, maybe about 70 or so years ago, it was hard to figure out when exactly to pick the tomato at the right time. Because wild tomatoes tend to have these dark green shoulders, and that makes it really hard to determine the right time to harvest. Ideally, you want to harvest when the tomatoes are sort of a uniform green color. Pick it at that time. That sort of ensures that they're a uniform red color when they're in the supermarket. That's been hard to do with wild tomatoes. So what breeders did over the decades was they basically bred tomatoes so that they would have this sort of nice uniform green color at a certain time. Farmers would go, oh, that's really easy. I can tell right away that one, that tomato needs to be picked, pluck it off the vine, ship it off to the supermarket.
So they built in an egg timer, basically.
They sort of did.
Tomatoes are done.
Right. But it turns out, according to this new study, that building in that egg timer actually may have had some not so positive consequences. When the researchers compared wild tomatoes to these tomatoes that have been bred pretty intensively for the past few decades, they identified changes in a gene that's called SLGLK2. And this gene is a transcription factor. And that what that means is basically it's a type of gene that controls where and when other genes are switched on and switched off. And what's interesting about this gene is it seems to be responsible for increasing the formation of chloroplasts in cells. And in plants, chloroplasts are really important for photosynthesis. They take the energy of light to convert carbon dioxide into water and sugar. So the more chloroplast you have, theoretically, the more sugar you have in the fruit.
And chloroplasts are green, and they're responsible for the green color in different parts of the plant.
Exactly. So now you've got this link between the color that the farmers are using to pick the tomato and potentially the amount of chloroplasts in the fruit. What the researchers are saying is that it's possible that by selecting for this uniform, lighter green color, breeders were also selecting for a mutated form of this gene, which caused less chloroplasts to be made. The fewer chloroplasts, the less sugar you've got in your tomato.
There's the food connection.
There's the food connection, exactly. The less sugar you've got, theoretically, the less tasty these tomatoes are.
And you say theoretically because no one can taste them.
Apparently, according to our story, the researchers, for whatever reason, apparently it's for regulatory reasons, were not actually able to taste some of the tomatoes they modified. What they did was they actually modified some tomatoes to boost the levels of this SLGLK2 gene to increase the number of chloroplasts. And they saw increase in chloroplasts, saw an increase in sugar, but they weren't allowed to taste the tomatoes. So we don't really know if these tomatoes taste any better than they do in the wild, but you would think they probably do because they've got more sugar in them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the only difference between a wild tomato and an agriculturally grown tomato. So we're not sure, right? That
right.
This is a big difference.
And in fact, actually about 80% of the sugar in a tomato is actually produced by the leaves. So even if you're mucking around with the fruit itself, you may not be drastically changing sugar content that much to the effect that you might get a better tasting fruit. So this may not be the holy grail of why tomatoes taste like cardboard, but it's sort of an intriguing possibility.
All right. Well, what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a cosmic mystery about the rapid disappearance of a warm, dusty circumstellar disk. That's all I'm going to tell you about that. Also, a study about how poker might shed light on social decision-making. For Science Insider, our science policy blog, we've got a story about new patenting regulations in Europe. Also, a story about new ways to spot scientific fraud. And speaking of scientific fraud, this week's Science Live is all about ethics in research, why there's been a rise in retractions, a rise in scientific misconduct. We'll have some experts on to talk about that. And next week's Science Live is about the Higgs boson, which there's been a lot of talk about this week. We'll have some experts to chat about all the implications of discoveries that were just announced. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
All right, David. David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the July 6th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.